Global News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Sullivan County is critically low on responding angels. Hope Not Handcuffs is a joint effort by law enforcement and community groups to provide treatment options for individuals looking to overcome addiction to prescription drugs, alcohol, and other substances. This morning, we're joined by the Village of Liberty's Chief of Police, Stephen DeGatta, and Paul Ricard from Hope Not Handcuffs about the need for more volunteers. It's Friday, and Dan Hoos has come up from Monticello to tell us about what's going on with Sullivan County government. And the final installment of the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance 2024 Salon Series is this weekend. Plus, there's a discussion about George Orwell's 1984 in Honesdale tomorrow. Cultural reporter Valerie Manzi has a preview of both arts events. But first, the news from NPR.
Next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks open higher this morning as the Labor Department reported stronger than expected job growth in March. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 110 points in early trading.
U.S. employers added 303,000 jobs last month, considerably more than forecasters had expected. Many of those gains were in healthcare, local government, and construction. Bars and restaurants added 28,000 jobs, while factory employment held steady. The job market's proven to be surprisingly resilient in the face of high interest rates. That's allowed the Federal Reserve to take its time before cutting borrowing costs. The unemployment rate dipped in March to a low 3.8%, even as 469,000 people came off the sidelines and joined the workforce. The rising number of workers is helping to keep a lid on wage growth. Average wages are up 4.1% over the last year, likely outpacing inflation. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke with President Biden yesterday. Israel has now announced it will reopen or expand three crossings into Gaza to permit more aid for Palestinians to enter. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says the U.S. is pleased with the news.
We welcome the announcement last night of additional crossings being open and expanded hours at some of the existing crossings. That's all good. It's a good thing and it's a good start. But what we're going to be looking for over time is whether Israel meets those commitments to allow that additional assistance in.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Israel has also released its investigation into the deadly attack on seven World Central Kitchen workers in Gaza. It has dismissed two senior military officers and reprimanded two others. World Central Kitchen officials are demanding an independent third-party investigation of the attack. The U.S. says it is reviewing Israel's investigation as well. Former President Donald Trump's campaign expects to raise $43 million at a fundraiser this weekend in Palm Beach. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports that number would break the record just set by President Biden's campaign in New York.
The Trump campaign is promising it'll be the largest amount for a Republican Party fundraiser by 100%. The former president has been keeping a relatively low profile since becoming the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party, but his team has been actively reshaping the Republican National Committee and ramping up fundraising. This week, the campaign announced that Trump and the RNC had raised more than $65 million in March alone. The Biden campaign has largely been outraising Trump, so a $40 million-plus fundraising haul will be compared to Biden's big night last week, where he was joined by former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton in New York City for a star-studded party that raised $26 million for the Biden campaign. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up about 80 points. This is NPR. The final four face-off in the NCAA Women's Division I basketball tournament is tonight. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports one of the matchups features top seed in Iowa with star player Caitlin Clark against UConn.
Before Caitlin Clark became the all-time leading scorer in Division I college basketball and the household name she is today, her first March Madness ended, like so many others, at the hands of UConn. That was back in 2021. The Huskies overpowered Iowa 92-72. Now, 3 years later, a national title is just about all Clark has left to achieve. Her Iowa team is a 1 seed. UConn is a 3 seed, led by star guard Paige Beckers. The winning team between them will go on to face the winner of the other Final Four matchup. That's between 3 seed underdog North Carolina State and the dominant South Carolina Gamecocks, who are the tournament's top overall team. They haven't lost a game all season. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
The men's Division I Final Four tips off tomorrow night in Arizona. 11th-seeded North Carolina State faces top-seeded Purdue in one semifinal, followed by number 4 Alabama against top-seeded UConn. The winners face off for the championship Monday night. It's the first time two schools have made it to the Final Four in both the men's and women's tournaments. A wintry storm that hit New England this week is pulling away into the Atlantic. It dumped feet of snow. Meanwhile, in California, officials are warning of more rain on the central Pacific coast. Residents in the Big Sur area are being asked to evacuate. The main highway has been damaged, and residents could be stranded. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. C3.AI. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Friday, and Dan Hoos, the communications director from Sullivan County Government, joins us, as he does every Friday, with an update from the Sullivan County Legislature in Monticello. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Happy Friday.
To you as well.
You made it through the rain, literally. And the snow.
Yeah.
And the wind.
And the sleet, I heard, and the power outages.
Happy spring.
Yeah. I was away for it, and of course, that's when the bad weather hit, and I apologize. It must be my fault. So,
yeah. The government center was closed because of a power outage.
Yeah. They shut down about 2.5 hours earlier than normal. So, because the power, I don't think the power came back there until very late at night anyway. So,
there were a lot of folks impacted in the county and in the region. Let's talk about the legislature that they were able to meet. And they are talking about some addition of personnel at the Office for the Aging.
Yeah, this wouldn't necessarily rank in and of itself for something that I would bring up on the radio, but it illustrated an interesting point. So let me explain just a little bit of background. Yesterday, the legislature was meeting about Office for the Aging needing, they were hearing from the Aging Director Lisa Andul and the Community Resources Commissioner Laura Quigley about the need for another driver, a ninth driver to add to the rank of 8 drivers they have currently that do everything from medical transportation to delivering food. And they were saying that when just one of those folks calls out, that they have to then assign office staff that have jobs and duties in the office to go out on the road. And the staff does it. I mean, this is an office that is very people-oriented. These folks love to help people. But we have folks to work in the office. We have folks to be out on the road. So they were asking for an additional full-time driver to add to the ranks. And the legislature is going to take that up for consideration and a vote, I think, either next week or the week thereafter. And so there was some discussion, though, by legislators as to the cost of that, not individually the cost. Josh Potosik, the county manager, was asked, you know, can we afford this? And I think Josh's answer was by itself, sure. When you take a look at the entire overall expenditures that especially a new legislature is eager to investigate and make because they want to commit and make a mark and help taxpayers as they should. When it's taken in the whole view, though, just a little bit here and then a little bit there and then a little bit there and a little bit there, suddenly you have a tax increase coming in the next budget. So you have to actually look at these things at the individual level and at the entirety level. And that was what legislators were discussing yesterday is we can afford this. There is a need there. But in the long term, is this something that is going to contribute towards a tax impact on taxpayers? And of course, there was the argument with this particular kind of position, who would say no to such a thing? On the other hand, if you keep saying yes over and over and over and over again to adding a position here, adding a program there, suddenly you find that it's hard to balance the budget without any kind of tax increase. And of course, we've got the state that likes to come with unfunded mandates, which we're really concerned with this next state budget, that there will be some potentially heavy burdens upon counties. We don't know exactly what those are yet.
You don't have the budget yet because the budget's been delayed.
Right.
And they don't seem to be in a big hurry.
No, they don't seem. But our budget depends upon their budget. And unfortunately, we can't budget after. We have to sort of budget ahead of time because we run on the fiscal year that matches the calendar year, but the state doesn't. So anyway, all of this is to say that it was an interesting debate that happened yesterday, and I encourage people to go on our website and watch those meetings just to get informed, but specifically for this debate as to, hey, this is a position that really could benefit us. Some legislators are saying it's worth the cost. And other legislators were saying, yeah, but hang on a minute. We've got to look at this in the entirety of what we're doing and the other things that we want to accomplish in the county. And it's the kind of dilemma, I don't know if I would call it, what was that movie with Meryl Streep, Sophie's Choice? I don't know that it's to that level, but we are talking about people's lives here. It's the kind of dilemma legislators have to face more often than you might think, because in the end, we would love to offer every possible service that we could to every possible person in Sullivan County, but that is not fiscally possible. So we have to pick and choose. But sometimes in the heat of the moment, you're like, well, we need this position. Let's get it done. And then you find out later, whoops, there's going to be a cost with that that we didn't budget for.
And it just illustrates the process of keeping that budget at the forefront, even though as you mentioned, the county's budget is on the calendar year. So you've already adopted the budget for this year, but you're waiting to see what's happening with the state, who's still dragging the feet a bit, and then also preparing for next year.
Yeah. And the last thing you want to do, too, is add a whole bunch of positions and then find out in the next year or two, you're going to have to lay off people because you can't balance the budget without a double digit tax hike. So this is a balancing act that I don't envy the legislators having to do, but it's a necessary one. And sometimes it means tough choices are going to be made. Now, that said, I'm not saying they're going to reject adding a ninth driver to serve our aging population. In fact, I would say the odds are probably pretty good that they will.
But taking that up next week?
I believe so. Could be the week after there at the executive committee or the full board meeting, but I believe they're going to make a decision this month on it. But again, even if they do say yes, as like I sort of anticipate they will, that has a financial cost to it all. And taxpayers fund a fair portion of the county budget. So that's always got to be kept in mind.
Let's talk about something that's already been budgeted. The construction at the Sullivan County Airport. We've talked about the Sullivan County Airport before, and I think we've seen recently some drawings of the terminal building and what that means. Let's just remind people what the service that the airport provides and why this construction and renovation is happening.
Yeah, this one has been a bit confusing and, to be frank, aggravating to some county residents who feel that the airport is just a playground for the affluent, which, listen, there are very wealthy people who house planes there. There are also middle-income folks, actually, who house planes there. I'm definitely in middle-income, and I learned to fly there years and years and years ago. The airport has always had a bit of a reputation as a white elephant for Sullivan County, and I get that because it's never been self-sustaining. The dream that created it back in the late 60s never materialized, that there was going to be a casino and an explosion of resorts to bring more folks in. Instead, actually, one of the first things it did was help shuttle folks to the Woodstock site for the Woodstock Festival. So it's got an interesting history there. But the terminal definitely there was reaching the end of its useful life. And the state said, listen, we want to – this is a Governor Hochul initiative. Yeah. We want to put new infrastructure in smaller airports upstate, all over upstate. So they said, hey, Sullivan County Airport, we'll give you $18.5 million to build a new terminal. Now, I get it. There are people who say, $18.5 million, I think I'd rather have that spent here or there or whatever. Sullivan County didn't have a choice. We either took that money for this or we didn't get that money. It's state money.
It's from the Upstate Airport Economic Development and Redevelopment and Revitalization from the New York State Department of Transportation. Mm-hmm. So it is state money.
But it wasn't taken with the idea, oh, we're just going to, you know, make this even more exclusive than it was before. We have a vision at the county, led by the legislature, county manager, our airport manager or airport administrator, to really make this a self-sustaining place where it relies less and less on taxpayers funding it and more on those affluent people that might be coming in and using it, or just the middle income folks, because it's going to have office space to rent for aviation companies. We are going to attract more, hopefully, professionals in the aviation world who might want to rent hangar space or just come for what we call the $100 hamburger, which is where people, and people do this. They fly into airports large and small across the country just to have a meal or a drink. There's a tiny airport in Homestead, Cherry Ridge Airport, that has a wonderful restaurant with expansive views of the runway. It's packed every time I go. And I'm sure the people who run the airport are making money as much as the folks who run that little restaurant there. There is going to be a restaurant in this terminal. The idea is, like I said, to make it less and less of a burden on taxpayers, more and more to self-sustain. We have seen that that potential is there because our fuel sales, we started really investing in our fuel infrastructure, our aviation fuel there, have increased by hundreds of thousands of dollars over the past few years. There is a demand for this, especially when airports closer to New York City are getting more and more crowded. So we have this facility. We need to make the best use of it as possible. So this money is not being spent on some sort of lark. There is a strategy involved here that when this terminal opens, hopefully in May of next year, that we will have an opportunity to really make this what I've been calling a business jet port, a center of business aviation activity that will hopefully ultimately benefit taxpayers.
Will it also create some jobs?
Yes, yes. Construction jobs is going to create several hundred construction jobs to begin with, but then there will also be job opportunities because I think there's going to be around half a dozen rentable office spaces, so people will need folks to man those offices. There will be a restaurant on the second floor, so you're going to need to have folks who can cook and can serve. I remember when there was a cafe there, and at times it could get very busy. This will be an even nicer restaurant, which will have what the cafe didn't, which is views of the runway. So there will be jobs available there. And it also, of course, you know, this facility isn't just the airport. We also have our 911 center there. We have Hatsola Air is based there, with their jets that go all over the world. So there's more going on than just what would happen at this terminal. And like I said, we really want to make it something that locals can be proud of, even if they never fly or they don't use it. There's not going to be passenger service there, that maybe they stop by at the restaurant, and that maybe down the road that there's less of a chance of a tax increase because this thing is actually serving it itself in terms of making money for itself, that the revenues are enough to cover the expenditures.
I wonder if there's a certain sense of maybe criticism or the feeling that this is only for the affluent from some folks. Also because there's a lack of service for people in the area, and they see this shiny new thing here. And then if I drive to Stewart, I'm not going to get as many services as I did out of that airport. Limited services out of Scranton. You know, I have to drive it to Newark or LaGuardia and to get anything. I think maybe that might be part of it, too.
Oh, yeah. That's,
I know that it is all, for me.
That all fuels into it. However, there will be – actually, there even is now, I think, occasionally. You can charter a flight from there, but, of course, that's going to be more expensive. Well, but I'll mention, too, for example, we have Civil Air Patrol there. That's for young people who are interested in a career in aviation. They actually can learn all about aviation through these Civil Air Patrol meetings there. So, yeah, in terms of the average Joe – or Josephine, who wants to just catch a flight to Florida or to Myrtle Beach or whatever, this airport, I'm sorry to tell you, will never be that, at least that I can foresee. Stewart itself has trouble maintaining flights in and out of there.
And it's part of the New York, New Jersey authority, Port Authority. Yeah. Let's move on. Broadband survey, we mentioned this last week. I want to reiterate that. And have you had some good participation with that?
not a huge amount of participation, but the reason I want to bring it up is the deadline's coming up soon, April 11th, that you need to take a look and see if your property is correctly marked on this broadband map. We have links to it on our website and on our social media. It's the state's map that they're going to use to determine how to allocate almost $700 million in federal funding to improve broadband access. The goal in New York State, and certainly for us in Sullivan County, is broadband for all, or as close to 100% as we can get. We're working with a private company to string new broadband cable in areas that hadn't had that before, and then also provide it wirelessly to places that it'll just never be profitable for a company to string cable. But this broadband map is necessary for the state to understand who needs money. And we're going to say we need some of that funding to reach some of our areas that have never had broadband. There are still people who are on dial-up in Sullivan County, which boggles my mind because most of us talk about that as if it were a relic from the last century. But people are still using that because they have no alternative. So if you have a chance, go take a look at that map. If you click on your address and it's already a red dot, that's a good thing. That means that they know you're unserved or underserved. But if it's a white dot, which says that you're served, but you know that you're actually unserved or you have really lousy service, we need to know about it. The state needs to know about it so that we can make sure that we are accurately representing to the state what Sullivan County's current issue is with broadband.
We're talking to Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday with news from Monticello. There are some seasonal job openings available that you want to talk about.
Yes. We actually have quite a few. A lot of them focused on Lake Superior, which is a state park, but we have an agreement with the Palisades Interstate Park Commission to actually do the operations of it, and we employ the staff there. And we have a whole bunch of seasonal positions open there, including lifeguards, which I'm really happy to say we now offer lifeguard training and certification. We used to have to outsource that and tell people to go other places. And like Fallsburg at one point was the only place that had a pool locally. And then they had to shut down their pool for renovations. And it became such a difficult thing. We can do it now. We'll work with you if you want to learn how to become a lifeguard. You're a young person who is in reasonably good condition. We can train you for that. That's what we need the most of, and we'll start you out at almost $21 an hour. But we have other seasonal positions as well. We're very flexible with those, that we could work with you on the different hours if you want to do this as part of other summer jobs that you have. We start operating Memorial Day weekend, and then we'll operate daily starting June 22nd through September 2nd. Why is that? Because that coincides with when school's out. Because we expect a lot of these summer seasonal jobs to be taken by teenagers. However, we also have a lot of other full-time jobs, or if you're an adult and you're looking at a seasonal job but you want something maybe more indoors, we have our interpretive center for the Delaware and Hudson Canal down at Summitville. That's one of those things, if I retire, I would love to do in my retirement, is you sit there and welcome people to this little museum and you answer their questions about the canal down at Summitville. What a great way to spend the summer. You can be indoors, you can be outdoors. Indoors when it's raining, outdoors when it's sunny. We also have plenty of full-time jobs open. If you're interested in any of them, go to our website and click on Find a Job.
And there's a summer youth employment program as well that's separate from these jobs.
That is different. And that is for 14 to 20-year-olds who, you know, they could apply for these seasonal positions, but these will be under more of a supervised environment where they're working as part of a team, not necessarily individually. There will be a group of other young people their age, and they will be doing specific tasks, everything from, I think we've helped with community gardens to litter plucking, all sorts of interesting things. It'll change as the summer goes along, so it won't be like these seasonal positions. They're the same thing all summer long, like a lifeguard. This summer youth employment program will switch things up from time to time, and it's a great way for young people who maybe have never had a job before to get involved in the workforce and get prepared for it. And kids have a great time. We end it with a wonderful picnic at the end of the year through our Center for Workforce Development.
Litter pluck has begun. Now, yesterday we had on the folks from the Upper Delaware Council talking about litter sweep. Uh-huh. This is litter pluck.
Yes.
Is this like the Jets and the Giants?
Well, they sweep, we pluck.
Yet another initiative to get things clean.
It's
here.
Just a whole community-wide effort to keep us looking at our best. And I'm sure inspired in part by Sullivan Renaissance, although I think our litter pluck may even predate that kind of a thing. But it's from the same idea that we need to look our best, and we feel better when we look our best, not just people who come to visit us. So litter pluck has begun. It goes all the way through October. If you pick up a bag of trash along the roadside, if you actually pick up all that litter, and it will quickly fill up a bag, I've done it, you can then go to our transfer stations, and with a coupon that they can provide you right there, dump it for free anytime all year long through to October 31st, after which we expect it gets a little too cold out there to be litter plucking. Although if you still want to, please do.
All right, let's talk about a few other things before we go. The Alzheimer's Community Forum was supposed to happen on the 3rd, but it's been rescheduled.
Yes, this was something that we were doing in concert with Cornell Cooperative Extension. Due to the weather, they had to reschedule. From April 3rd instead. Now it's going to be Wednesday, April 24th from 2 to 3:30 p.m. at Cornell Cooperative Extension on Ferndale Loomis Road right here in Liberty. This is about sharing your experience with Alzheimer's disease, hearing about others' experiences, and discussing how we can all work together to help. Because this is, I had a great aunt who had it, and her husband took care of her, but it was draining on him. That it was really intense. And this was a person he loved, but she didn't know him anymore. So we really need to rally around each other and be supportive to one another. So if you have somebody in your family who has Alzheimer's and you're caring for them or dealing with them, come on to this forum, because I think you will find a community of people who understand and want to help.
What a support. Also a blood drive coming up in Monticello.
Yes. We have on Friday, April 26th, so I'll be mentioning this a few more times when I see you, from 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., we are going to be hosting, and it'll be our county wellness committee, we will be hosting a community blood drive. So it's not open just to county employees. It's open to everybody. It's in a very convenient place in the hearing room in the government center, 100 North Street in Monticello. Again, that'll be Friday, April 26th. It's just really important that we have people continuously giving blood, because there's always a need for it. And my understanding is it has a very short shelf life.
Yeah. And there was a dire emergency over the winter, and, you know, catching up to those blood supplies, making sure that they're full. And then National Public Health Week is now. I want to say a special shout out to the public health team.
Just this week, wanted to say it to everybody that I work with over at our public health department. These are folks who work long hours, but do it because they love helping people and serving people. And sometimes, especially during the pandemic, they were beat up a lot about the vaccines and, you know, as if they were made political when they aren't at all political. They're just trying to do the best they can for the people of Sullivan County to care for their health. And they really do care for their health. These are folks who are in the community making home visits. They're giving vaccines at the office. They are staying up to date on the latest contagious diseases, always planning for the next outbreak. Hopefully it won't happen, but it can.
You never know.
They are working with the camps during the summer, as we had talked about, I think, last week. So these are folks who work very, very hard, and I don't think always get the appreciation that they deserve, so I want to give it to them right now. You guys are great. I am so privileged to work with you, and the people of Sullivan County are so fortunate to have you in their service.
Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday with an update from what's going on at the legislature in Monticello and all the county government activities. You can find out more at sullivanny.us. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
See you next Friday. And we'll take a quick break. When we come back, the Hope Not Handcuffs program faces a significant need for more volunteers. We'll be joined by the Village of Liberty's Chief of Police, Stephen DeGatta, and Paul Ricard from Hope Not Handcuffs, live in studio next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution cfosny.org, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hi, this is Jeff, your host on Radio Catskill's new show, Electric Mountain, bringing you a choice selection of dance music from back in the day to today. I'll also feature a guest DJ every week spinning a continuous set, bringing their unique style. Come dance with us each and every Saturday night from midnight to 2 a.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local. Yeah, let's go.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sullivan County is critically low on responding angels. Hope Not Handcuffs is a joint effort between law enforcement and community groups to provide treatment options for individuals looking to overcome addiction to prescription drugs, alcohol, and other substances. The program offers a way for anyone struggling with substance use disorders to seek help, either by visiting a participating police agency or calling a designated hotline. When folks reach out, they're met by a volunteer known as an angel. Currently, the program faces a significant need for more volunteer angels, and a training session is scheduled for April 11th. To discuss more about the program and how to get involved, we're joined by the Village of Liberty's Chief of Police, Stephen DeGatta, and Paul Ricard from Hope Not Handcuffs here in studio live. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming in. Paul, how does Hope Not Handcuffs work? I briefly described it, but how does this work for someone who's struggling with addiction?
There's a couple programs, but the one that we're talking about right here is where somebody gets to the point where they recognize they need assistance, they need help, would walk into one of our participating agencies, Liberty being one right here in Sullivan County, and they can go to the person or at the desk or any of the officers in the field and say, I need help. And they're going to be, if they're not at the police station, brought to the police station, and we're going to try to get them the help that they are requesting and they need.
How has this community involvement from these volunteer angels helped and impacted the effectiveness of this program?
Well, I think Steve probably can talk to the couple times that we haven't been able to supply them. They're a key part of it, right? So when the agency calls us, we try to dispatch two angels to the location. And they're there for comfort. They're there to help with paperwork. They're there to facilitate and help with the process of getting that person placed into a treatment program if that's what we're looking to do immediately, or get them set up for treatment the next day, depending on the time of the day and so on and so forth. So it's critical. These people are volunteers are critical. They're very important. They help the process. And Steve can probably talk about the lack of angels we've had a couple times and how that's impacted.
Yeah, Chief, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the shortage that we have is actually, in some respects, kind of a good problem, because what we've really done is we've outgrown the existing volunteer angels that we have. The program has been so successful at the Liberty Police Department and other Sullivan County agencies that the amount of individuals walking into our lobbies and asking for help has exploded, and so we need to keep up the pace with volunteers willing to do that. So the police department and the Hope Not Handcuffs organization, I kind of like to think of as like the backbone of this program. But the angels, they're the heart and soul of the program. These are people that are regular volunteers, regular community members, their mothers, brothers, husbands, wives. A lot of them either have lived experience themselves or have had someone in their life that's been affected by the opioid epidemic. So these are people that truly care. And when they show up to the police department, they're able to, like Paul said, provide that compassionate, empathetic response and guide that person who's in a real dark spot at that point, step by step through the process that can sometimes be a little daunting between paperwork, insurance, transportation, bed availability. So they're there to hold their hand and get them through it.
The program is in 65 police departments throughout the Hudson Valley. Are there volunteers needed across the entire region, basically?
Absolutely. We can use volunteers everywhere. I think the shortage is more acute right here in Sullivan County right at now as we speak, but we can use volunteers all over. We run these programs in various communities. And I think the important thing too is to remember that if you are a volunteer, you're not going to be out there on your own. You're going to be supported. You're not going to be abandoned. The officer is going to still stay in the area with you and in the building. You're going to be calling our Hope Line, which is what the hotline number that we call, that we speak about. So the angel is going to get direction and get support both, in what kind of information to give out. So this training kind of outlines that. So I think sometimes people are afraid to volunteer for this kind of role because they're not really sure how much support they're going to get. They get nervous, and that's really no need for that. This training is just a little bit of a exposure to it, and then we'll walk you through it, the process as it's happening. You're not going to be just showing up at the police station. It's on you to place somebody. That's not how it works.
Well, and I appreciate you saying that, because I'm sure that there are people listening that might feel that this is an intimidating prospect in this area. We've talked about this a lot, the opioid crisis, even though we're doing a little bit better in our area, thank goodness, thanks to organizations like this. At the training session next week on the 11th, what could someone expect when they kind of go to the session to learn about this?
Well, they're going to talk a little bit about the stages of addiction and recovery and what people are going through. But it's also going to teach them the process and how it's going to work and the support that they're going to have when they're out there and what they're going to be doing to play. When we say place them, it's actually the Hopeline person on the back end on the phone that's actually doing the work. You're there to get the paperwork done, the volunteer, to offer support. We have the angel bins, which have some light snacks, light drinks, maybe some toiletries, some change of clothes. The angels are going to facilitate getting that to the person that's sitting right in front of them. So it's not heavy lifting, but it's critical, critical important.
And how long is this session for the folks training on the 11th next week?
It's 2 hours.
Yep.
Okay.
Two-hour session.
And where is it located?
It's going to be at the Sullivan County Emergency Services Training Center, which is on Old White Lake Turnpike in Swan Lake.
And how can folks get more information about that?
So they can check on Hope Not Handcuffs Facebook page, also the Village of Liberty Police Department's Facebook page. There's a poster with a QR code to pre-register for the event.
As you look forward, Paul, with the program, what are some of the goals you have to increase the services for individuals who are coping with opioid addiction or addiction?
One of the really exciting programs we're working with the chief here and also in Fallsburg now is our quick response team. So we're doing actually outreach with one of our peers. They go out with a police officer, so it's kind of twofold. We're working on building that relationship between the community, the police, and also us. They don't have to worry about being arrested by the police. They're going to be met where they're at, and the police and the peer are going to then actively go out, outreach, try to get that person help. And we're identifying these people through attempted overdoses or overdoses, non-fatal overdoses. Maybe someone has a substance abuse problem in jail. Trying to reach out for them through that process. Maybe we go on a call and the officers go on a call and they identify somebody that might need a follow-up. So that's really, I think, the next phase of this is the active outreach with the peer, not just standing by waiting for the person to come to you.
Yeah, I was going to say, with such a broad area that we're talking about throughout the Hudson Valley, and then just also the stigma attached to this, and Chief, we've talked about this a little bit too, when you've been here in the past, like just letting someone know that it's okay to reach out, especially to reach out to the police. Are there some challenges about this awareness engagement for folks who are struggling?
Sure, because I think typically people don't think of going to the police that when they have a substance abuse problem, right? Because the police typically and traditionally have arrested people for having drugs, right, on them, that, you know, whatever the drug was. So I think there's that little hill to overcome. And I think, you know, one thing that we always say is like the police always want to help people. So, you know, this is important. And with our changes in the criminal justice system, it's far better to help people and get them into a treatment program than just to arrest them and release them and let them go through this continuous cycle of, you know, arrest, release. Let's try to get people into treatment to try to help them long term, help them and their families.
Well, and hence the name, Hope. Not handcuffs, mm-hmm. Right? Let's remind folks of the number to call if anyone's is struggling with addiction or someone you know might be struggling, the hotline, and then also where folks can get information about the training session on the 11th if they want to become one of these angels to help folks in need as well.
Sure. So to register for the event, they can go on the Village of Liberty Police Department's Facebook page or Hope Not Handcuffs Facebook page. Someone who is struggling with substance use disorder can reach out to any police officer in Sullivan County, walk into any police department lobby. They can also call the Hope Line at 833-428-HOPE. There's also an online submission on the Hope Not Handcuffs website where if they still are a little hesitant to maybe walk into that police station or make that phone call, they can put their information in online and they'll be reached out to.
Yeah, and I think before we go, just the thing that you want to make sure folks know is don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to seek help. Don't be afraid to offer this kind of help.
Absolutely. I think it's important. And listen, even if you're not sure, come to the training. If you're not 100% this is for you, if you think it may be just for you, come sit, listen, and we'll meet you where you're at as well. Yeah. Like, we're going to maybe walk you through this, and maybe you want to take, you know, dip your toe into the, you know, into the pool slowly as opposed to jump right in. And we're willing to work with you as well.
Paul Ricard from Hope Not Handcuffs and Village of Liberty's Chief of Police, Stephen DeGatta. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Much. Thanks for having us.
Quick break for us and back with more Radio Chatskill right after this.
I'm Callison Stratton, a singer-songwriter, public historian, and host of Liberation Station here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Liberation Station is a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers across genre and time. It's my little way of balancing the scales of representation on the radio. Join me for Liberation Station every Saturday evening at 7 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. There's a certain book that begins with a man starting a diary. The date is April 4th, 1984. The man's name is Winston Smith, and the diary is a crime. The book, of course, is George Orwell's classic 1984. In recognition of the 40th, quote, anniversary of the book's opening date, Known Grove Books and More in Honesdale is hosting a discussion tomorrow, 1984 plus 40. It's facilitated by local writer and activist Skip Mendler. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Mendler yesterday.
Good morning, Skip, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Good morning, Valerie, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, this is a wonderful opportunity because you are going to be leading a reading and discussion event this Saturday from 1 to 4 mm-hmm. p.m. at Known Grove Books in Honesdale. Mm-hmm. And the event is entitled 1984 plus 40. Explain.
Right. Well, we're actually speaking on Thursday, and today is April 4th.
Yes.
We're listening, you know, everybody will be listening to this on April 6th. But April 4th is actually an important day in the book 1984. The protagonist, Winston Smith, buys a diary, and his first entry is dated April 4th, 1984. So I thought that was an appropriate day. I call it Winston Smith Day informally.
Okay.
It'd be cool to make it a real day, you know, because it's like every few years, 1984 is one of those books that every few years you want to stop and you want to kind of look back and go, are we closer to that or are we farther away from it? And just check yourself, you know. I designed something for one of these events. I was saying it was 1984 plus 20.
Yes.
In 2004, and I made this little survey. I can't find it now on SurveyMonkey. I'm going to have to replace it. But it was the 1984 Index, and we looked at like 20 different aspects of the society that's portrayed in 1984. And I wanted to know, you know, where people thought we were in relationship to that. Now, you got to remember, this is, you know, only a few years after September 11, 2001. And we were still kind of reeling from the shock at that point.
Sure.
And that was when I started to really start to think about fascism and social trauma and 1984 and authoritarian societies and all the rest of it. So it's an interesting thing to kind of go through and look at some of these aspects of this culture that Orwell talked about and see where we are.
Yeah, it's like taking an inventory.
Precisely.
And in fact,
I thought of expanding that concept to bring in other dystopias, Brave New World and Handmaid's Tale and We and all these other books. And so, you know, how much of which one of these do we have? There have been plenty of dystopian visions.
There are, and I had not been familiar with We until this summer when there was a production of it at the Delaware Valley Opera. It wasn't an opera, it was a play. There's no lack of dystopian thought throughout history.
And with good reason, you know, people can see where present trends are leading. And I think that's one of the things that science fiction or speculative fiction does for us, is it kind of extrapolates from where we are and ask, you know, if we keep doing what we're doing, where will we end up? And these are all, you know, kind of cautionary tales about what we happen to be doing at the moment.
Now, the event itself, you'll be doing some readings from 1984?
Yeah, the idea, that first event that I did at 1984 plus 20, I did a marathon reading of the whole thing.
Oh, wonderful.
It takes about 11 hours. We did that at the Wayne County Public Library. And that's kind of cool. That's fun. But I want to zoom in on certain specific areas. And that, because it's such a rich book.
Yes.
There's so many different things in there. I mean, you know, the average citizen, if they've heard of it, they know Big Brother, perhaps. They know about the idea of this continuous surveillance. They know about newspeak. They've heard the term Orwellian used in news stories a lot and opinion pieces about what government does with language. So they're aware of certain tropes and ideas that are in there, but there are others that I think get overlooked a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and that I wanted to shine a little bit more of a spotlight on. For example, there's a section of the book where Winston, the protagonist, gets a copy of, like, this, you know, the Underground Resistance Manual,
mm-hmm.
which may or may not have been actually written by the Underground. It might have been written by the government. You never know. I call this the nonfiction section of the book because Orwell takes this opportunity to take the phrase "war is peace,"
yes,
which is one of the mottos of the party, and really explain what that means. You go through, you go, oh, okay, yeah, I see what they mean by that. It's also the best explanation for military spending, military waste that I've ever seen.
How so?
So he's talking about industrial production, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about, you know, all these goods. People will get comfortable. And if people get comfortable, they'll have time to educate themselves. And if they have time to educate themselves, they will realize that they don't need their ruling class, and they will rise up and get rid of it.
So we can't have that.
So we can't have that, right. What Orwell suggests is that the powers that be saw this and said, well, what do we do about that? I think he says you can just dig a hole and dump everything into it after you make it. But you could also just have wars and use up all this surplus, and then you have enough, you know, to keep going, and you have to educate your people to a certain extent, but not too much. This explains some of the things that people say, like, well, why is it we have enough money to send to this country or that country, but we don't have enough to apply to improving our educational system or our healthcare or whatever? This tends to answer that question a little bit. Another area that is interesting to look at, there's a fascinating discussion that happens between O'Brien, Winston's supervisor, and whom he thinks is his way, you know, to get connected to the underground, but turns out to betray him and to be, you know, bigwig with the Thought Police. And there's a long section where Winston's being tortured by O'Brien, you know, break his will and bring him around to the party's way of thinking. And they talk about power. O'Brien asks him, you know, why do you think we do this? And Winston, who's still kind of idealistic, is, well, you know, you're obviously trying to better society or it's more efficient or da-da-da. He says, no, not at all. We do it because we like it.
Wow.
The object of power is power. The object of torture is torture. And particularly when you go back now and look back at things like Abu Ghraib and you look at Guantanamo and you look at what's happening now, in various places, you wonder if there aren't actually people just like that out there in the world, and they have positions of power, and they like to use their power to make other people suffer. It puts the these various things about national security and things like that in a different kind of context.
What year did Orwell write 1984?
It was published in 1949.
And he had already been through a number of wars himself, World War I, Spanish Civil War, World War II. He knew about war. Another quote I remember was, freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
Once you deconstruct them, by war and peace, as he says, when you have constant war, it's the situation that they have is they have these three entities, Oceania, East Asia, and Eurasia, and at any given time, two of them are at war. And if you're at war with East Asia, well, you've always been at war with East Asia. Right. And there's a bit of comic relief in the book, in fact, where the switch gets made in the middle of a rally. And everybody's like, wait a minute, we're at war with East Asia. Why do we have all these anti-Eurasian banners? Who's done this? It's sabotage. Let's get rid of it. It's a little bit of comic relief, but that's another to illustrate our situation here. It shows how people can change their thoughts on a dime when the government is the one that tells us the truth. The whole idea of doublethink, which is a fascinating concept, I like to say is the closest thing that we have to it is kayfabe, the way that wrestling fans treat wrestling. We know it's not exactly real, but we're going to play out our role and pretend it is real. I always say you cannot understand American politics without an understanding of professional wrestling. I'm looking for a good discussion with folks. And we don't have to stick with necessarily the ideas I have. I'm sure people have other points that they would love to discuss with other people about it. It's definitely the time to do that type of thing.
All righty. Thank you.
You're absolutely welcome. And thanks again. And thanks to all the listeners out there at WJFF for their support.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. I want to update you on some breaking news that happened while we've been on air, something you may have felt. A magnitude 4.7 earthquake shook buildings across New York City and the region shortly after 10:20 this morning, according to the United States Geological Survey. The USGS reported that the earthquake's epicenter was in Lebanon, New Jersey. That's about 50 miles west of Manhattan. And the folks on the Upper Delaware Network listserv are reporting that they felt it here in our area, too, in Berryville, Beach Lake, Newfoundland, Long Eddy, also in Calicoon and Damascus. In our offices, Mimi Bradley said she felt it here as well. I didn't feel it while we were in the studio on air, but Mimi said she thought it was a large truck going by, as some other folks have reported as well. Again, it's a magnitude 4.7 earthquake, according to the United States Geological Survey, epicenter in Lebanon, New Jersey, 50 miles west of Manhattan. This is a developing story, of course, and we'll update you throughout the day. Meanwhile, we have another report from culture reporter Valerie Manzi, another event happening this weekend. It's in Narrowsburg, the sixth and final installment of the 2024 Salon Series. It features Richard Holler's one-person show, E.
E is first initial of a woman named Edith Speziali, who was my best friend for 21 years. And this E is the story of our friendship. And it started out as just, I just wrote all of this down because I just wanted to remember her. And I would tell stories about her friends and stuff. And people just kept being so engaged by her that I thought, well, let me see if I can put this together into something. And I did it as a one-off at the Cornelia Street Cafe, thinking I'll just invite everybody who knew Edith and we'll have a great time. It'll be like a memorial, you know? And instead, what happened is very few people that knew her showed up, but the place was filled with people who came to see me, you know, like my newest work or whatever. And they loved her and they had never met her. And this convinced me that this piece had some legs and that it could go out into the world. And I did do it as a series of staged readings. And because it's 40 pages of dialogue between me and her. It's funny, during the pandemic, as terrible as it was, it gave me the time to sit down and learn these lines. And so now I go up and I tell the story without a book, and it has lifted it up into a whole different plane. It's just nice to walk into a room and start telling a compelling story about a fascinating person.
And you have an interesting story of how you both met.
Yeah, we met working at a upscale hardware store in Soho. And, you know, she was the catalog lady. I was the returns guy. But we were both, you know, we were both artists. And I was running a little theater company and I was trying to, you know, I was in my early 20s. I was trying to get my acting career going. And she had spent a lot of time in the art world, but had never really, you know, lived as an artist. So she was kind of a secret artist, but had that real sensibility and the talent, which we later found out was there very much. And we just, you know, because we were like two kind of lost souls amongst everybody else who wasn't very much interested in the arts, you know, we just were drawn to each other and became close friends. She was 40 years my senior, so it was quite a generational gap, but we connected on such a basic level. And then I essentially became, you know, as time progressed, I became her family. I became the person that she relied on to take care of things, and saw her through, you know, to the end of this journey that we're on.
And what year did this friendship begin?
It began in 1981.
Wow.
And yes, and she died in 2001.
And a relationship with that age difference can be so enriching for both.
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, she had such, you know, just the stories of the past and the things that she had done and the perspective that she had and the history that she knew was just so incredible. And then she just appreciated the fact that I was young and full of energy and creating art and, you know, just unstoppable. And she appreciated that. And both of those things worked really well together.
And what was her art form?
Visual artist. Worked mainly in black and white ink, you know, black ink on white paper. That was her preferred medium. Although, I mean, I'd seen her do other things, but it wasn't until the last couple of years of her life that she really began to draw like in a fever. And I mean, I have so many of her works, and they're just stunning. People come in, they go, "Who did that?"
It's like, well,
an unknown artist, you know.
Unknown artist, yeah.
Yeah.
And you're a playwright yourself, correct?
Yes, I'm an actor and a playwright and a singer, and you know, I've kind of, you know, had to do it all in order to keep working in this business, which I've happily done for, you know, most of my career, or all of my career.
Wonderful.
And so you know, it's nice to be able to be creative in different venues because it allows me more opportunities for work.
In reading a little about you, you worked with at-risk youth and incarcerated folks as well?
Yes, many years I worked with at-risk youth here in the city. And it was during that time when I was doing a play that someone came to see the play and saw that I was a teacher and worked with, you know, in tough situations, and asked if I would be interested in teaching a master class at a prison upstate. And I said, sure. And I went up there thinking I'd be doing that for a one-off. And it's 14 years later, and I'm still running the workshop. I'm heading up there today to teach a class, and then tomorrow night to do the theater workshop. It's a weekly thing.
What did you find made you connect to that particular situation?
You know, I it's funny. I'm always fascinated by how comfortable I was walking in the room the first time, and how I was with the kids too, because I was not, you know, a tough guy when growing up. I was a nerdy, arty kid. Do you know
okay.
what I mean? Like a scaredy cat, you know, got bullied. And so I found it fascinating that I would walk into this room and I was absolutely fearless. I have a book coming out in the fall called Acting Out, and it plays on that term of acting out, that I'm amazed at the amount of talent that is locked up or that is stuck in a poor neighborhood. A lot of these kids are just bursting with talent. These men that I work with, And to me, in a lot of ways, this was the missing thing in their lives when they were young that steered them mm-hmm. in the wrong direction. You know, all that energy, all that acting out went the wrong way. Yeah. And it's very gratifying to be able to harness that now and to, you know, focus it into a really positive place. And, you know, it's been a remarkable journey, and it has certainly impacted my life and my work. You know, it has affected me. I think I'm a better actor, a better director, a better writer because of working with people who really, really just immerse themselves in the work 100%, you know.
How wonderful for them, too. Kind of a desperate situation there.
I know. It's the one, you know, in that room that we work in every Friday night, a little bubble is created, and once the work gets going, it's like the walls go away and the guards go away and everything. You know, they're just living in the joy of being creative.
That's impressive. Well, let's just sum up a little here so folks know mm-hmm. when and where this event is happening. It's at DVAA in the Gloria Krauss Recital Hall in Narrowsburg, 2 to 4.
Right.
And it's
That's
the
correct.
Final event of the Salon Series. Thank you so much, Richard, for taking the time. And also thank you for the work you do with youth and the incarcerated.
It's one thing that, you know, Edith had always encouraged me, and I'm sure she would be. I know that if she were still around, she would be at every prison show. Do you know what I mean? Because it was something that she really believed in, too. So it's nice that that's kind of in this show that that's referred to, you know, as well.
Thanks to Valerie Manzi for that report. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. Radio Catskill. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.